Hello and welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Let's start this episode with some numbers. In the post-World War II period, 40% of American workers were private sector union members. That number is now below 7%. The reasons behind this drastic decline are hotly debated. Union supporters say greedy corporations helped by politicians have worked systematically to bust the movement. Detractors say corrupt leaders, improved labor laws, and global competition have served to make unions less relevant over time. The economic impact of the decline of unionism is also a contested issue. But we know this. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2013, only 11% of all U.S. workers belonged to a labor union, public or private. The reason that number isn't much lower is public sector unions. In the period from 1983 to 2013, public union membership actually grew as private membership declined. Today on Speakers Forum, we present a debate focused precisely on the role public sector unions play in the overall health or weakness of the labor movement. Taking opposing sides are City College of New York professor Daniel DeSalvo and UW political science professor Michael McCann. DeSalvo is the author of Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences, and a senior fellow at the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. McCann is a former Guggenheim Fellow and the director of the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies at UW. With the aid of KUOW's Ross Reynolds as moderator and questions from the audience at Town Hall, DeSalvo and McCann defend their research at length with helpful insights and conclusions. Town Hall Seattle and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this event on January 13, 2015, as part of the Civic Series. Sponsors include Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. Here, Town Hall's Edward Wolcher introduces the debaters.
Daniel DeSalvo is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the City College of New York, CUNY, and a Senior Fellow at Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. His scholarly work and commentary on politics, elections, and labor unions have been published everywhere from the New York Daily News, the Weekly Standard, the Public Interest, National Affairs, and elsewhere. And he is the author and co-author of a number of books on politics and labor. He will appear in debate about the power of public sector unions, the subject of his new book, with University of Washington professor Michael McCann, who is the Gordon Hirabayashi Professor for the Advancement of Citizenship. McCann is also director of the UW's Comparative Law and Society Studies Center, director of the Law Societies and Justice Program, and a 2008 Guggenheim Fellow, and was recently recognized for his work as an outstanding graduate mentor at the UW Graduate School. Moderating these two in debate is KUW's Ross Reynolds, a dear friend of Town Hall who's helped us out in many ways here before, also a veteran of many a candidate debate in our region, and he is the host of the daily news magazine, The Record. So please give a warm welcome to our guests.
So much for coming out. I've been really looking forward to this, having read Daniel's book, and whether you agree with it or not, he presents some really interesting arguments that we're going to get a chance to get into here. Our format this evening is going to be fairly simple. There'll be 10 minutes first from Daniel. By the way, that's Daniel on the far side, the guy with the tie. And this is Michael on the near side. How many people are related to Michael, by the way? He said he had some relatives here this evening. Okay. So there'll be 10 minutes from Daniel, 10 minutes from Michael, then 5 minutes each sort of to respond to one another. And then I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative to ask 15 minutes of questions of my own, roughly. And then you'll have a chance to come to the microphones to ask your own questions. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has recently been mentioned as sort of a second-tier Republican candidate for the presidency. And he's well known for his animosity towards public employee unions. So although this is an issue that is not quite simmering at a high flame at the national level, I'd be curious to see whether that's something that he brings into the campaign, and if he catches fire, as he might, whether this becomes more of a national debate. So we might be talking about some things that you'll be hearing a lot more of in the coming months and years. So to begin, let's hear an opening statement from Daniel. Go right ahead, Daniel.
Well, thank you very much for that generous introduction, and thank all of you for coming out tonight to listen to a debate about public sector unions, a subject that really until Scott Walker's reform efforts in Wisconsin had lying dormant, and people didn't really care and weren't really interested in it. And I also want to thank Michael for agreeing to come out, and it's a real honor for me to be up here with such a distinguished scholar with such a long and distinguished record. So let me get right into my book. I think I'll have to be a little bit more polemical tonight because this is a debate format than I think I am in the book, but that'll be a little bit more fun. I think public sector unions have been really at the center of state and local government and our politics since the Great Recession. Obviously, Wisconsin really brought the issue to national and international attention, but in many states, from Indiana to Michigan to Rhode Island to California to New York to Illinois, this is where the action has been in state and local government. And I think that going forward, we're going to see public employee unions as being really getting a lot more attention in the press and in the media and the subject of a lot more scrutiny than they had been prior to 2008. So I think that prior to 2008, journalists didn't cover public employee unions very closely. Scholars didn't either. As I document a little bit in the book, there's when it comes to labor historians, political scientists, there just isn't much written looking at public employee unions. So my book is really the first to try to take on this big, vast, and fascinating subject and kind of synthesize what we know, offer some new research, and make some arguments or conclusions from that. So, and I think it's very interesting because the study of public employee unions is really fundamental to our political life, because if we're studying the state, we're really studying the political activity of government's own employees. So what do I argue in the book? Well, I start out and I try to make a conceptual, I think very important distinction between unions in the public and the private sectors. A lot of us, myself included, came into this project thinking about unions as being sort of more older style industrial or craft unions, guys in hard hats, steel-toed boots, who worked very difficult jobs on a day-to-day basis. And that was a sort of image, a romantic image many of us have, but that's not really what the labor movement looks like today. About half of the labor movement in 2009, for a little while, a majority of all union members were public employees, many of whom are relatively affluent with master's degrees or college degrees. So this distinction, public and private, I argue it can be made in a number of different ways, why these two entities are different. First is history. Public employee unions have a very different historical trajectory. Private unions are governed by national law, passed primarily in the 1930s and then supplemented it at other points. Public sector unions are governed by state law and local ordinances passed really in the 60s and 1970s. So as private sector unions have declined, public sector unions have remained very stable or constant. So their histories are different, their sources of law are different. And I also argue that the way they operate and their policy effects are different, which is to say public sector unions get what I call two bites at the apple. That is, they can win things directly for their members, first through collective bargaining, and that failing also through politics, that is, through participating in the political process, electioneering, and lobbying, in a way that their private sector counterparts can't. Third, public employee unions are different in the sense that they can exercise influence on both sides of the bargaining table in a way that private sector unions can't hope to do, which is through that second bite at the apple, that is, lobbying and electioneering, public employee unions can gain some influence with those who are acting as management in a way that private sector unions, whether that's machinist unions, has here in Seattle, has no say over who Boeing's CEO or CFO is. And that's not the same in the public sector. And fourth, the big difference between the two that structures the incentives and behavior in different ways is that there's a lack of market incentives. That is, markets really structure the dynamic between private sector unions and management, and there's a lack of market forces in the public sector where the government is often the monopoly provider of many services or the near monopoly provider. So then after I make this distinction, I go into trying to document what is the power of public sector unions. So there I try to get as much empirical data, and I can't share with you all the richness of it in 10 minutes, on the how much public employee unions spend on campaigns. That is, how much they give to candidates, how much they spend on initiatives and referenda campaigns. What's their lobbying spending? And then I look at some of their overall political advantages compared to both private sector unions and other interest group players that are trying to get their way in American politics. And those differences include they have easier access to politicians, they have much more easy to mobilize their membership for election campaigns and protests, rallies, because they're public workers themselves, they're right on the foot of the state capitol. Third, they have a much more steady and stable revenue stream through dues checkoff and agency shop legal provisions. We can explain what those are later if people are interested. And fourth, as I said, up until the Great Recession, they were really operating in a low visibility policy environment without a lot of media or public scrutiny. So not only do they have a lot of political power, and again, just to give you a couple of examples, for example, the California Teachers Association outspent the next three largest interests in the state combined in the first decade of the 21st century in donations to candidates and parties. In New York State, for example, the state Democratic Party is very honeycombed in with many of the public employee unions in the state, firefighters and teachers, even to the point of sharing its campaign office is basically office space shared with the United Federation of Teachers in Lower Manhattan. So that's what I mean when I get at the question of access. Then I look at some of the incentive structures in collective bargaining in the public sector and why these, or I argue, tend to favor the union position over time. And this mainly has to do with the political incentives or management incentives in the public sector where politicians are operating with different time horizons than their union adversaries. And there's a lot of information asymmetries. The unions very much know what they want. But politicians aren't always so clear what exactly is in the public interest. So what's the effects of this power? I try to marshal a lot of empirical evidence to show that basically the effect of allowing public employees to unionize and bargain collectively has increased the cost of government through increased pay, increased benefits. For example, cities where firefighters are unionized pay on average about 9% more in salary and about 25% more in benefits than cities where firefighters are not unionized for no measurably different increase in service quality or fire protection. Second, I try to find some empirical evidence and to show that it actually reduces government productivity, that is the union negotiation of work rules that often shield workers from management can stymie or squelch innovation in the public sector such that, in a sense, management that you're paying agency managers in different areas really doesn't have many management rights or many management tools, so you're paying management, but they're not able to really manage in that sense. So productivity is reduced. Managers can't credibly threaten workers with dismissal. They can't transfer them. In some cases, they can't even assign them duties that would be appropriate to their skills. Third, I argue that the effect of backloading, and this is an interaction between collective bargaining and defined benefit pension systems, is what I call crowding out, the rising cost of pension and health care for public employees, that is pushing so much of their compensation back into retirement. Has led to a squeezing of public budgets such that, you know, activist government can't do things that it might otherwise want to. I think I'll basically kind of wrap up here as I'm running out of time, but I would say that there's obviously been raised some questions of whether agency shop provisions, other provisions surrounding collective bargaining in the public sector actually compromise workers' rights, and that's been the subject of Supreme Court litigation in two high-profile recent cases, Knox versus SEIU and Harris versus Quinn, whether this is actually a violation of some workers' First Amendment rights by organizing this way. And I guess I would just finish with promoters of public sector unions or defenders of public sector unions haven't, as far as I can tell, really made a positive case for why organizing our public labor markets in this way benefits the broader public. That it benefits the public workers themselves is clear, and it would be surprising if it didn't do that. But what benefit rebounds to taxpayers, to the consumers of public services? I have not seen a strong, powerful, first principled case that it does do that. I've seen some negative cases that it doesn't have certain negative effects, but I haven't seen a powerful first principled case, and I just leave it there.
Great. Michael McCann, 10 minutes to talk about public unions.
Thank you. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here, and thank you for the opportunity, Daniel, for talking about what I think is a very important issue, which is public sector unions. It's important. We were chatting just before we came out, we're both political scientists, that the study of unions in general, especially public sector unions, has received very little attention from political scientists, and so this is a welcome opportunity. I should say I'm not a specialist in public sector unions, and I'm not a debater by trade. We were talking about that as well as social scientists. Yeah, we are now. So we're going to try and play the role as best we can. I should say that I am here in the introduction. The primary reason why I think I was designated or asked for this is I'm the director for the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies at the University of Washington. That's my current role. So we're going to start the debate. And I think just because you may not want to sign it later, would you sign my book? Thank you.
Michael, I'm from New York. Don't worry, you can't.
All right, so let me start with one point of agreement. One point that 100% agreement. Daniel begins his book by saying that he's very much in favor of private sector unions. He comes from a private sector family background, and that he appreciates the role that private sector unions have played in terms of representing workers, providing workers a voice, counterbalancing the power of concentrated capital, promoting conditions for safe and healthy work, for raising wages, providing social security, lobbying for social security, for health benefits, and for really contributing to the rise of the middle class over the 20th century in America. We agree there. Where we disagree is about not so much whether public unions are different, but whether they are different in a negative way, in a less beneficial way. Is where I disagree with him is that public sector unions are inherently more selfish or narrow in their goals, that they are less democratic in the means by which they advance those goals, in which they impose costs on government and more broadly on the citizenry that squeeze out other kinds of agendas, and especially those that might benefit the most disadvantaged. So, I should point out, because I'm not sure it's clear from this talk, my reading of your book is a large part of the argument is really about the shortfalls in pensions that are making for a crisis within government and the squeezing out other kinds of funding. And while there's certainly talk about a variety of different public sector unions, teachers play a very important role. My opening comments aren't going to say much about teachers, but I do hope we get to talk about teachers and teachers' unions. So let me start with the economic argument about pension shortfalls and about the fiscal crisis that I see to be very much driving what this book is all about. Daniel's right that there was a well-demonstrated, palpable shortfall in funding for pensions that became apparent in the last seven or eight years. The degree of that shortfall and how much it's a crisis, people will disagree about. But one of the things that's important to emphasize is that the shortfalls were really quite different in different states, and that's going to be very important to what I want to say about the causes. There's lots of information in this book, coverage of lots of different unions, lots of information about union stability over time, about how much union workers make, about the pensions and so forth. But what I didn't see in this book was a clear causal argument, evidence that there's a lot of assertion that unions impose these costs. But I didn't see clear evidence that really made a clear causal connection between what unions were doing and the problems that we see and the costs that they are imposing. I do see the evidence of costs. Certainly the states were experienced deficits, and many states experienced shortfalls in the funding of pensions. We see that unions are very active in terms of bargaining at the table and also engage in electioneering, as you called it, and campaign contributions and lobbying and so forth. But I didn't really see the clear evidence that there was a causal connection between those. Now, to my reading, there actually is good data about this, good data that really helps us test this basic thesis about the causal impacts of public sector unions. And so I'm going to invoke work of a number of economists, labor economists, in particular Alicia Manil, who's the director for the Center of Retirement Research at Boston College, Sylvia Allegretto, is at the Industrial Relations Center at Berkeley, the sort of dean of labor economics, Richard Freeman at Harvard, and a number of other scholars. I'm not going to bore you with all the numbers, but give you just a picture about what they've said, because they've been looking at this issue to try and test whether this argument about what public sector unions have done really stands up. So a lot of things they have told us, some of what you mentioned, which is the public sector has been relatively stable over a period of time. The overall number of public sector workers since the early 90s has been stable. The amount of the percentage of state budgets, the percentage of workers relative to the population, of all that's been relatively stable. There wasn't some rising trajectory that created some sort of crisis. We also know from the data that public sector workers make roughly an overall compensation what the private sector counterparts do. They tend to make less wages, and there's been a lot of study of that showing that public sector workers as a whole, now it may vary from particular occupation, but as a whole, make 93 to 96% what private sector counterparts when one controls for experience and skills and so forth. But they do tend to have more generous pensions. And that, in some ways, is relevant, I think, for your argument. When you balance out lower wages, higher pensions, compensation is not radically different. And I do want to say that the book begins with some sort of examples of public sector workers who are retiring on lots of money and have made lots of money, but I think that's really misleading about the overall picture. Okay, the other thing that we know from these various kinds of studies is that there's no correlation between union density. Both collective bargaining laws, the states with collective bargaining laws, and union density in states, and either the deficits that we saw in the states in the last 10 years, or the shortfalls. There's a very small linkage between the density of public sector unions and the shortfalls, but that's corrected according to Sylvia Allegretto and her colleagues, who, once you add in the control for housing costs, that difference, that correlation no longer becomes statistically significant. Okay, so if several scholars, like Alicia Manil in particular, said, are public sector unions really responsible for the shortfall? And her answer is basically no. But she does offer an answer by looking at lots of different variables. What she found, the strongest explanation for what happened with the shortfall pensions was two related things. One thing was the overall fiscal crisis that first kicked in 2005 and then got much worse in 2007 through 2008, 11, and the recession that we're just coming out of. That, of course, created massive budget deficits, about 8.5% on average in all the states. So if you put that together with the states that experienced the greatest shortfall, the explanation is amidst the crisis with those states that experienced very bad management by politicians and those that they appoint as managers accounts for where those shortfalls are. Now, that data, to my reading, is quite consistent and quite compelling. And we have a lot of, so the aggregate data suggests that you put together the fiscal crisis that then exposes the fact that there had been mismanagement. What's the mismanagement? Mismanagement is that workers and employers, public sector, pay into long-term pension plans. Well, what politicians were doing was not paying all the money that they were committed to workers into those pension plans. They were siphoning it off for other purposes. They were diverting it to other kinds of causes. And what happens in the fiscal crisis, the deficits of 2005 to 2011, is that all of a sudden the states are in crisis and exposes the fact. And you can look at specific case studies, like Kentucky, which is probably the worst. And I draw here partly on Chris Tovey's book, Kentucky Fried Pensions. Chris was an accountant who became a whistleblower to the SEC about the mismanagement in the state of Kentucky. And what he shows is that the politicians only paid about 28% of the money that was committed over time, and then when the fiscal crisis hits, They have this massive shortfall of unfunded liability into the pension plans. There are other states not quite as bad, but like Illinois that had 38%, other states not quite as bad yet, but still had up 50 to 6% of unfunded liabilities, such as Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, your home state, but New Jersey. Okay, you've got to hit that. California, there's a number of states. But it's only some of those states. Some states did not experience a shortfall. One of the primary states that didn't is Washington State. Washington State, the money for the pensions was paid in. There are various adjustments over time. There are various adjustments that were negotiated with the unions. And that in 2000, there was 100% coverage of the pensions. When the economic crisis hit, all but two very old pension plans were funded at 100%, and they were just barely under 100%. So that the argument, and Lisa Minnell makes this very, very convincingly, as do these other economists we talk about, was that the real reason was political mismanagement, was politicians who were siphoning off funds. Okay, so this is a story, and that's the primary story. The public sector unions didn't control that. The politicians have to make their decisions. So quick, do I have...
You're out of time.
Out of time. Okay, good. I will raise the other points.
Okay, 5 minutes to respond from Daniel DeSalvo. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you. I appreciate Michael's comments. I'm glad he picked up, I'll sort of take them in order, which is, in a sense, he starts out with the negative case. That is that public employee unions, it's not that they're good, it's just that they're not doing harm, which is to say that they didn't contribute to deficits during the recession, and I cite in the book the Allegretto study arguing that. That they're not responsible for pension underfunding. I also cite the Minnell study and her book, which I also reviewed. However, those aren't the other studies out there. And if I wanted to even make Michael's case stronger, that is the no harm case, I would also add that they're not overpaid. So those would be the three points of the negative case. They're no harm. They're not overpaid. They didn't contribute to pension underfunding, and they didn't contribute to budget deficits. But that's still not a positive case, and it still doesn't take into account, I think, the vast amount of evidence that I show of the downsides of the costs. Now, I don't want to, in 5 minutes, get into the war of the studies. But Sylvia Allegretto and Alicia Minnell aren't the only scholars out there. And there are others out there, some excellent scholars like Terry Moe at Stanford, who has a good paper coming out in one of the top peer journals in political science that shows that the public employee unions, using the same sophisticated empirical techniques, were responsible for driving up both the size of pensions and their underfunding in some key states. Now, I'll even leave aside whether public employee unions are responsible for not for the underfunding issue in some states. You know, there's clearly some bad actors where there's a lot going on. New Jersey is one of them. Illinois is another where the pensions are in really bad shape. But leaving that aside, I think there is a good causal connection to show that the size of the pension, even if they're well-funded using, again, the government's current accounting techniques, which are also a little bit questionable. My home state of New York, for example, is 100% funded if you use the 8% government discount rate. However, the size of pensions, as public employee unions have grown since the 1970s in strength, the size of pensions, that is their overall liabilities, are enormous. They went from being, say, roughly 25% of a state's budget annually now to being the liabilities being three times, or even in some cases four times, the size of the state's budget. So these are much, much larger funds that are much, much riskier. And in order to make those returns to stay 100% funded, a lot of the pension funds are now getting into much riskier investments in hedge funds, in equities. That's part of another story. So I still didn't hear a sort of, and then to take Michael's second point, that there isn't a causal connection. I find that kind of interesting. If one lays out, I think as much as I do, the evidence for how much power in state and local governments public employees are exercising, the amounts of money they're contributing and spending, there's a clear causal connection between that and certain pay raises, certain work rules that are negotiated, and if one had reversed it and provide those evidence, that same evidence, and taken out wherever I put public sector unions and put corporate business, everyone would have said, oh yes, there's a clear causal connection. I think partly that can be a kind of ideological point, which is to say in social science, a clear causal connection, I think we can make our best judges, but even the most sophisticated empirical techniques, it's still going to be a very delicate question whether you have an ironclad causal connection. But I think there you do see as far as political science goes, this is about as strong a causal connection that these costs are being driven, and some of the effects that I lay out are driven in part or in whole by public employee unions. I'll leave it there.
Michael McCann, your rebuttal.
Okay, I'm going to do two things as quickly as I can. One is the politics of this, because I think the politics of it is very important, and I'll try and at least start to make the positive case. The positive case is sort of easy to me, but okay. But, there's a politics to this, and I think it's very important that at this time of what we get is 2010, 2011, we have budget deficits again, 8.5% on average around the country. We have these shortfalls in a number of states, and you have politicians who are trying to deal with this crisis. And the crisis creates both a challenge but also an opportunity. One thing it does is it provides an opportunity for political leaders. What are they going to do? Are they going to say, well, we're the ones who mismanaged it and therefore it's fine? No, they've got to find someone to blame. And who do they find to blame? They find the public sector unions. They said the unions are the ones who caused that, and they scapegoated the unions. And that's part of why we see all this attention to public sector unions, because they're the ones who caused the crisis, even though I will suggest that the best statistical data we have does not show that there really is not even a vague causality. It's rejected by the primary people who study that. So that's the first thing. Second thing is some of the scapegoating is clearly political, is that, after all, a lot of public sector unions give more to Democrats than they give to Republicans. So what you find in some states, take Wisconsin, where Scott Walker, who makes the brunt of his sort of challenge or attack on the unions, but what does he do? He exempts the police and the firefighters because they tend to support Republicans, or at least they're more divided in their support. So they go after the teachers, and that's what happens in a number of these states where there's an effort to scapegoat the public sector workers, and it's not entirely Republicans against Democrats supporting, but it's mostly. And there are some exceptions like that. I have to get into it. Rhode Island, you do mention Gina Raimondo, but she's very divisive within the Democratic Party. She's clearly making a bid. But so there's a politics to this. And the third thing that's really important and isn't addressed in the book at all is what's going on, that there's an opportunity here also for financial investors, is that beginning in the 1970s and 80s, private pensions were replaced by 401k types of private investment schemes. Many of you probably have retirement funds in those. And there's been an effort to, and the primary argument is we need to replace the pension funds in the public sector with those private investment schemes. Well, there's a lot of people pushing that, and that's largely the private investors, the same private investors who got us into the economic crisis to begin with. And what they want to do is they want to push governors and legislators to make the workers pay for the cost of the shortfall in terms of higher contributions, lower benefits, lower wages. Washington State, we haven't had cost of living raises or any raises for public employees in the last 6 years. To do that, and then to turn over the investment plans to the hedge fund brokers who are going to invest that and make tons of money in their fees. And they're the ones who are trying to break up the unions. Well, that's quite a deal. That's quite a deal. And even by American standards, that is a pretty shocking story, I think. So I think there's a whole larger story here, and there's none of it in the book. There's none of the book about the politics of this, and especially the fact, I should say, that some of the people who have a direct interest in pressing for the financial reform that is going to go to the private investors are fellows, are board members of the board at the Manhattan Institute, where you are a fellow. So I understand there's a connection there. Okay, real quickly, the positive case for the unions. Well, if you just take what I just said, are public sector unions, teachers and police and firefighters, less democratic than hedge fund managers who want to take over these $2.6 trillion in funding? And one of your points is that public sector unions are not the counterbalance to concentrated capital or to owners or employers the same way they're in the private sector. Of course they are, because a lot of what they're doing is pushing agendas which are about raising wages, about increasing work in the public sector, but they're working with the private sector unions together. That we see all kinds of alliances between the public sector and private sector unions. And the last point I make is one of the arguments is that, well, they're playing democracy at two ends, at the bargaining table and legislation. Well, people do that all the time. I contribute to interest groups. I contribute to partisan politics. I rally in the streets. I go argue in debates. Well, not debates, but in public forums like this. You know, unions, because they're pushing democratic politics multiple places, are increasing democracy, and they're doing it increasingly with alliances with private sector for the great many underpaid and insecure workers. So.
This is getting good. Rather than throw in some questions to kind of throw it off track, Daniel, I'd like to hear you respond to some of what we just heard from Michael, particularly to the last point of you say that public unions have two bites of the apple, and Michael's saying, well, look around, that's taking place in a lot of areas.
Well, I guess I wouldn't start there because it's not in the same way. You know, if you take the two bites of the apple part, you know, public employee unions are really the only one that get to negotiate with government or with their employer directly for salary, benefits, and working conditions, but can also lobby that same employer through the political process for that. Now, many of us participate in civic life. All of you are here. I assume many of you are civically engaged. You may contribute to the Sierra Club or the NRA. You may go to protests and rallies, but those groups have to, in a sense, get people who are interested in guns, who are interested in the environment. They have to organize and to make their case, right? They don't get to collectively bargain with the government, too. And private sector unions, for example, they get to collectively bargain with their employers for pay, benefits, and working conditions. And they do certainly participate in politics, but private sector unions' participation in politics is for a broader agenda, not necessarily for things that are going to immediately affect the livelihood of their members. They may, in the long term, improve society, improve things for their members, but it's a much more long-term project than, say, lobbying the government for a pension sweetener that's going to change the formula that's going to allow people to benefit. So I guess I'd come back to Michael on a couple of points. I think he's being a little uncharitable to say that that I'm not citing the most sophisticated empirical studies. I think that they're in there. I think there are other studies than the ones that he wants to look at. I try to parse them as carefully as possible in a chapter on comparative pay. But if you look at pay premiums in the public sector, that's the term economists use for when comparable workers in the public and private sector, when there is a premium, if you look at the states where the premiums are the largest, they're also correlated strongly with the highest union percentage states. So I do think that there's an empirical causal connection there. I think I do also, in the book, in this extensive chapter on lobbying, look at some of the ways in which public employee unions have gotten into bed with some of the big financial interests that Michael decries, in the sense that they are very much involved and big hedge funds are very much interested in managing the money of these pension funds and have sometimes lobbied for pension sweeteners along with the public employee unions because there'll be more money for them to manage. I think on the political side, I didn't get to it in my initial remarks, but I would also say I do come back and say that one of the big problems that comes out of this on the political terms is that the rise of public employee unions and the ways that they've driven up costs and created this problem or contributed to this larger problem of crowding out has created a huge political conundrum for Democrats and really divided the Democratic Party over this. And you can see it whether you look at Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, Gina Raimondo in Rhode Island on one side, and then, say, the mayor of my home city, Bill de Blasio, or other politicians, the Illinois Democratic State Legislature on the other side. And this is a real divide within the, say, populist and centrist wings of the Democratic Party about how to handle this problem. Because if you're a Democrat and you really believe, or a liberal, and you believe that, you know, government can do a lot of good for people and a lot of good for society, you know, you're really between a rock and a hard place now with the rising pension and health liabilities, which are very, very large, as I mentioned, because they're squeezing out what you could spend to do on other things. They're cutting into library hours. That's what drove Gina Raimondo in Rhode Island to run for office in the first place, was she saw bus service in Rhode Island. She saw library hours being cut in order to pay these back pension liabilities. I'll leave it there.
One more quick question for you, Daniel, and a response from Michael, and then the microphones are open, and I hope you'll bring your own questions. Let's say that you're right, that public unions have an unfair advantage, that maybe that it's such an unfair advantage that it outweighs the benefits that they provide to the public. If that is so, what is to be done?
Whoa. Well, that's a hard question, one I usually try to duck. I'm trying to analyze this phenomenon that I think, you know, as Michael and I have both agree, hasn't been that studied. You know, I think, as Michael mentioned, and he's absolutely right, there's an enormous amount of variation. This book is mostly about state and local government, about states and cities, and there's lots of variation across the country, right? So some places have big pension problems. Think of Illinois, New Jersey. Other states have big pay premiums. My home state of New York, for public employees, that's the case, right? So and that's unequitable vis-a-vis the private sector where people are. So there are different problems, and those are going to require different solutions in different places. But I think in states where public employee unions are very strong, there could be different things that could be done, and I think it's going to depend on the culture of those particular places.
Michael, what are your concerns about what might be done should this rise of feeling that public unions take unfair advantage of the public takes hold and moves further forward?
Well, the whole premise is that I don't agree with public sector unions have imposed disproportionate costs and don't bring real benefits. So I can just address a couple of points that I didn't really get to address. One about this two bites out of the apple. I mean, one thing is that the two forums, legislation or electioneering for legislation and collective bargaining, tend to deal with other issues. By and large, and this has been pretty well documented, most of the wage issues are dealt with collective bargaining, but the pensions are really set through legislation. So those are different venues. So they need to fight in different forums. They can't bring to collective bargaining about the pension issues in most cases and so forth. So that's I don't really understand what you're arguing. The second thing about that is that when public sector unions participate in electioneering to try and influence legislators, they're only one small piece of the overall picture. They only have a limited number of voters. They do give a lot of money in some states in some instances for certain kinds of policies, but there's a lot of other people, and big business and financial interests are in almost every case giving more money when there's something really at stake for them to do that. But that doesn't even begin to get at the imbalance that exists, because large corporations don't often have to give a lot of money because of the dependence of states and cities on those large corporations who provide employment and sometimes provide taxes. Anybody in the state of Washington knows about Boeing. Boeing doesn't have to spend a lot of money on lobbying and so forth. They just say, we're going to leave if we don't get billions of dollars in subsidies. They don't have to do that. So to say that there's some sort of, you know, when public sector unions give money, that's all they have. The only thing that public sector unions have that's even marginally like that, we're going to leave, is the strike. But strikes are outlawed in public sector in most states. And in the states where they're allowed, in this context where public sector unions are being stigmatized as causing the crisis, which they didn't cause, they're not likely to really go on strike, because that's a very, you know, bad situation to do that. So that all this countervailing stuff, I really don't think it significantly addresses the issue of power. But let's come back to the positive issue. I think the other thing about not pressing issues that are democratic in character and contribute to equity and contribute to improving working conditions for workers and for the middle class, it's just wrong. I mean, public sector unions are aligned with private unions all the time and engaging in issues. I've been very attentive to and participating in the local minimum wage campaigns in SeaTac in Seattle. That was really pushed by a public sector union, SEIU, working with community groups, faith groups, other unions. It was a public-private union sort of a mixed project. But pushing that, and that has become one of the primary causes around the country, is minimum wages for everybody, not just for unionized workers, but for everybody, and pressing on a whole variety of social programs that will benefit working people that have been taken away or whittled away. And the final thing I say, I mean, to make this case that they're undemocratic in either means or in ends, I mean, the primary standard through your book, and this is really true in your talk, is really about markets and about the way markets work. And in many ways, what this is all about is contributing to sort of neoliberal project of privatizing government, privatizing the pension plans, just like we privatized prisons, and much of the contracting out of government, which is, I would say, not something that I would necessarily equate with democracy. For better or worse, whether democracy is better, but that's not a democratic project. It's not one that really contributes to equity. It's really feeding into the increasing inequality between concentrated wealth and concentrated corporate capital. I don't see where the solution is.
I would like to open it up to those of you who have questions. If you could just step to either microphone, step up close, unlike what I'm doing, or so they can pick you up well on C-SPAN. Say your name right into the microphone and give us your question. You, sir.
My name is Stephen Miller, and full disclosure, I'm a teacher. And I will very quickly, I will get to the question, but I want to help in the debate. I appreciate, Michael, that you pointed out that Boeing was able to hold the state of Washington hostage for the largest tax cut ever in U.S. history given to one corporation by a state government. So biting the apple, that is quite a big bite. They took it, $9 billion. But equating public unions to the budget crisis in state is the equivalent of saying the Titanic sunk because of the waiters and maids that were working on the Titanic that day. So let's work with a simple concept using economic principles. You want to know what unions do to create a positive impact. So would you agree, and both Michael and Daniel, this is a question for both of you, higher wages for the average worker provides higher wages and benefits for most workers?
Okay.
And Washington State's a great example because we have the highest minimum wage in the country and one of the lowest unemployments. So, and unions have played a very key role in raising wages in Washington State. So let's work on that simple economic principle.
Let's start with you, Michael.
For me? I think it's mostly for him because I heard you agreeing with everything I was saying. But if I miss it, you can tell me.
Well, I guess I would start out by just correcting the record. I don't argue in the book that public employee unions were the cause of the Great Recession or are the single bullet cause of the pension crisis across the country or that they caused higher deficits to go up. I don't argue those things. I do argue that states, and again, I've drawn Richard Freeman for the empirical data on this, states with stronger public unions tend to have higher levels of public debt, but that's different than the deficit. That's different than the recession. So I don't argue that in the book. And if anyone got that message here, take that away. To the gentleman's question, what I do find is you raise a really interesting question. There's an old, it's in economics, it's called threat effects. So if one company firm is unionized and raises wages, surrounding firms will need to match in hopes of staving off a union drive. So those union threat effects were that private sector unions could not only help the workers in, say, one plant, but in surrounding workers. To my knowledge, no economists or very few economists have found threat effects in the public sector. So the public sector can raise wages and benefits, but it tends not to have any effect on the surrounding labor market. And this goes back to a point that Michael's a little confused about. There is a deep connection between pay as negotiated through collective bargaining and pensions. Any pay raise is factored into the defined benefit pension formula. So the connection there, and there's often, at least anecdotally, when you do interviews, you discover this, that public managers will often say, look, we can't do anything for you, unions, on pay right now because that's factored into current budgets, but we can do something on the pensions longer term, and that'll be pushed off later, and you can get that compensation in return down the line. So the pay question is very much connected to the pension question because any pay raise is going to be factored into how the pensions are calculated and what people's final average salary is.
We can go to another question unless you'd like to say something, Michael.
Quick, two parts of response. On the last point, I mean, that's precisely what you just explained, is that politicians say, well, we can't really give you a wage raise now, but we can feed the the pension down the road, or vice versa, that's precisely what she means by mismanagement. That's undisciplined. There's an incentive for politicians to not worry about down the road, but to, you know, say, we'll give you this down the road, but then siphon that money off. That is built into the system. That's a problem. That's not public sector unions' fault, though. They're not making those decisions. They're not. They are, in some ways, the ones victim, because they're the ones who are losing benefits and losing security down the road and making concessions to pay for the politicians' irresponsibility. It's exactly what Monell argues is the problem. That's the first thing. Second thing, real quickly, about the impact of raising wages in public sector. That's just completely wrong, what you said. Is you raise wages in the public sector. I wrote a book about gender-based pay equity in the 1980s, and this was unions over 120 sites around the country, of which I studied almost 30 in depth, went and spent a lot of time there, and this was where unions worked with local civic groups to organize women who were unionized in the public sector to file lawsuits on their behalf, and then to take those lawsuits to collective bargaining to raise wages, because women's work was systematically underpaid. This is white women, especially women of color. This is the same issue that Martin Luther King went to fight for with sanitation workers when he was assassinated, which was to, because certain jobs in both public and private sector are systematically underpaid on the basis of race and gender. Unions led that battle, public sector unions. Well, what happened? In various, there were sophisticated economic studies in the Bay Area, because there was a major pay equity activity for 10 years in the Bay Area. When you raise the wages of clericals and secretaries and nurses in the public sector, that raised the wages of everybody else in the private sector as well. That's what we call markets, right? That's what happens. It has those ripple kinds of effects. It's not purely consequential that the wages of women that in the 1960s, on average, were only 59 cents to every dollar that men made, and there's a variety of reasons, not simply because of the wage-based pay equity movement, but that had a significant part, that gap closes from 59 cents to a dollar to about 77 cents per dollar. The downside to that is men's wages were stagnant or actually dropping, so it's not entirely a good story. But that's just one of the many ways in which what public sector workers do, raising wages, improving conditions, has ripples. Sometimes they're just local and local markets, but if you do it in lots of places, you hit lots and lots of markets, lots and lots of ripples. But explicitly fighting for causes like minimum wage is something that is not just aimed at public sector workers. It is aimed at raising the wages for everybody.
I'd like trying to restore middle class. At least a couple more questions in here. What's your name, sir, and what is your question? Get right close to the microphone, too.
Okay, my name is John Stafford. My question's for Michael. My question might imply that I'm sort of unsympathetic to public unions, but in fact the opposite's the case. I'm sympathetic and supportive. But my question deals with process, and it's my understanding in Washington State that when unions negotiate wage and benefit packages, the general structural model is that union representatives meet with the governor, they reach an agreement, it subsequently goes to the legislature, who can vote for it or against it but can't modify it. That's received a lot of attention with respect to, is that the appropriate process, and is there the appropriate level of transparency with respect to that process? So I guess my question is twofold. One is the Washington State model sort of replicated reasonably uniformly across the country, or are we sort of a standout in that respect? And second, do you support the basic process by which union contracts are negotiated at the state level? Thank you.
I should say I'm not an expert in specifically what does happen in Washington State at that level for that negotiation. I do know that the pension issue is largely a legislated issue, and that doesn't mean that unions don't have a role in that. They do meet with the governor, and they do present a case, and the governor then presents that in a budget, and the legislature can decide how to deal with that, which often means, but there is ongoing negotiation after that in changing that overall budget, which means the governor rarely gets the budget that the governor wants, at least in my experience in Washington State. I'm sure that there's lots of room for talking about, is that a fully transparent and democratic process? But that's different than undercutting, you know, public sector unions and saying they are the problem. That's a process, and the politicians are the ones who determine what the nature of that process is. So again, I would turn it back to, that's a political question, not something that's the fault, you know, the fault or the liability of the public sector unions.
Let's bring it back over to this side. Your name and your question.
Hi, my name is Karen Strickland, and also full disclosure, I'm a former community college teacher and the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Washington. So there's a little context for you. I'm a longtime activist in my union, and I would, so my experience is really completely different than what you were stating, Daniel, in terms of the role of unions in looking out for their own interests, as opposed to the collective good or the public good. And while I make no apologies for unions looking out for the interests of their members as working people, it's also the case that my union, and I think this is true of many public sector unions, have actually really led the charge to protect the people that we serve. So in my case, community college students in...
What's your question?
I'm getting to it. You know, in K-12 teachers, in human services, state workers have taken on that role. So I'm curious if you could elaborate on your thinking around the lack of a benefit for the public good in terms of union role.
Well, I'm glad that you raised that question. It's a really good one. It's come back, brings me back to a few things that, Michael has argued in trying to put forward the positive case, which is if you think about the activity of public employee unions, obviously you can think about it as a set in terms of the issue stance and the things that they're going to invest time, money, and energy on. They're a set of concentric circles. There's nothing wrong starting with their own interests in, let's say, the union leadership's own interest in winning the best deal for their membership. It would be surprising if that wasn't agenda item number one. If it wasn't, unions are, leadership is often elected democratically, someone would run against them and say, we can win a better pay, a better benefit, or better working conditions. So that's going to be agenda item number one. Going out from there, public employee unions today, and this really goes, are connected to private sector unions, and in some sense are supporting private sector unions. They're the heart and soul of the labor movement today. So Michael is right about that alliance. However, there's a lot of fissures in that alliance. If you look at private sector unions in many places, backed Governor Walker in his last election. They backed Gina Raimondo, whereas the public sector unions went with their opponents. So there are fissures in the labor movement between public and private. Beyond that concentric circle, public employee unions, as I briefly mentioned, are deeply embedded or braided into the larger Democratic Party. So they adopt, at least rhetorically, lots of the main issue positions of the larger liberal coalition. They often underwrite other activist groups on the left of the political spectrum, such as the teachers' unions, for example, has bailed out at a couple of points the NAACP financially. So in that sense, it becomes not a principled case for why this is better for everyone. It just becomes a partisan case, which is I support liberal politics. Public employee unions are the financial, they're the money and manpower today behind the liberal coalition, so therefore I support them. And that's, in a sense, the broader principled argument, such as it goes.
I'm going to take one more question for the public portion of the program, but I'm sure both Daniel and Michael will be around afterwards if you'd like to buttonhole them for other questions. You, sir, your name and your question.
Yes, Dan Kaplan. Has there been any analysis of the outcomes of Scott Walker's union legislation on, you know, the fiscal state of Wisconsin or at the county level, and of education outcomes at the county level as well, in terms of class size, of impact of other services at the state or local level?
There has been some analysis. I mean, of course, the big effect of Act 10 has been to reduce some union membership. Wisconsin's job growth was not as good as Walker promised. How much, you know, he deserves either credit or blame for that is always a subject of debate. Some counties were able, during the recession, counties and cities, most notably Milwaukee itself, were able to use Act 10 to balance their budgets in ways that they couldn't have done before. In terms of longer-term outcomes on some of the questions you mentioned on class size, I don't know of any, there's journalistic reports, but no reliable broad studies. It's a little early, I would say, for some of those empirical questions to be answered.
Daniel's going to be doing a signing over here afterwards, but I want to thank both of you for this really enlightening conversation. I've learned a lot from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. Town Hall Seattle and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this event on January 13, 2015, as part of the Civic Series. Sponsors include Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.